Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. I'm Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and I'm very excited to be here marking a milestone, the 200th episode of this podcast. I know it was decently recently that another podcast had a milestone. The Teaching Math Teaching Podcast just hit 100 episodes a little while ago, which is great. Congratulations to Ava, Dusty, Joel, and Jen over there. Definitely check out that podcast if you haven't. And I think this podcasting game is mostly about clarity of purpose and then just good old-fashioned perseverance. I know the guidelines for effective podcasting all say to have a consistent release schedule so your audience knows what to expect, but I've never been able to achieve that consistent schedule. I started out with a few episodes in my first semester as a faculty member in fall of 2012, and then my goal was to try to get to about 24 episodes per year, so that could be fairly consistent at 2 episodes per month, but I never quite made it there. I got into the low 20s for several years, but in the last few years, it's been more like 1 episode per month, and not always consistently per month. But what I lacked in consistency, I have made up for in perseverance. It is now over 12 years later, and we've hit 200 episodes. The podcasting guidelines also say to establish a consistent format that works, and then stick with it. I've sort of done that. The main format is definitely when I interview a scholar about a recent empirical article. But over the years, I've incorporated completely different formats as well. I've done 25 episodes that focused on a senior scholar's career in research. And for some of those, I had help from friends like Susan Empson and Michelle Cirillo as guest hosts. I've also done 11 digest episodes, which contain short summaries of several different studies. And those were with the help of Chuck Munter and many other people, so thank you for all who have helped with some of those episodes. And then there have been episodes where I capture a plenary or presentation from a conference event, using the podcast infrastructure to share that stuff to people who couldn't be there at the conference in person. So although the episode formats have varied over the years, I do think the podcast has maintained a clear focus, which is conversations about math ed research. And as a reminder, all of the past 199 episodes are all freely available. The podcast has a feed in most podcast apps, and mathedpodcast.com is a trusty homepage. Plus, the podcast is now fully on YouTube. And if you're particularly interested in the back catalog, I have a webpage at samuelotten.com that lists all 200 episodes, searchable by guest and topic. There's a link to that page from the show notes on each episode, so feel free to go back and listen to the episodes that are most of interest to you. Or if you teach a math ed course, feel free to humanize the math ed work a bit by using the podcast episodes to let students hear the voices behind the research. So, even though I haven't followed the podcasting guidebook perfectly, and even though I don't have any sponsorship for this endeavor, it's about perseverance, just like publishing usually is. And now with that perseverance, we've made it to 200 episodes, and the podcast has built a worldwide audience of over 2,000 plays or downloads per episode. And for me personally, it's actually been really cool this semester in particular, because it seems like I've been hitting several milestones all at about the same time. 200 episodes. And although I turned 40 before this semester, it's as a 40-year-old that I got promoted this semester to full professor. And I read my 1,000th book, based on a list that I've been keeping since middle school. I also added my 2,000th reference to my EndNote reference library. And I add those references manually, by the way. None of that automatic importing stuff, because my opinion is that if a reference is worth having in a reference library, then it's worth taking that minute to grab the author info, the title, the abstract, and the notes. With regard to milestones and my own publications, I haven't quite hit 100 pubs yet, but I think I will hit 100 in 2025. That's counting journal articles, books, book chapters, and articles in proceedings. Inspired by all these landmarks kind of happening recently for me, plus the reflective mood that kind of comes at the end of the year, I'm asking you to grant me a bit of personal indulgence for this 200th episode. I'd like to share my top 4 underrated articles. And by underrated, I just mean articles that haven't gotten much traction in the field yet, but they contain ideas that I still consider to be pretty interesting or valuable. And that's how I view articles, by the way, as an encapsulation of some idea that's worth sharing. Keith Weber once was here visiting Mizzou Math Ed, and he said that articles are not about publishing data. They're not even about publishing research findings. They are about presenting an idea. So I was looking back through my past publications and thinking about the core idea that each one contains. And I'm going to mention 4 that I think are underrepresented or sort of underrecognized to this point. But before that, let's look at the other end of the spectrum. I have 4 publications that have gotten significantly more citations than the rest of my work. The most citations I've gotten is for the NCTM book that I wrote with Courtney Kessler, Matthew Felton, and Kristen Bieda. It's called Connecting the NCTM Process Standards and the CCSSM Practices. And I'm proud of that one because I think it's a great explication of all eight mathematical practices, with examples at both the elementary and the secondary levels. And for a solid decade of my career, I mostly worked on classroom research and teacher education around the mathematical practices. Second most is for a discourse analysis piece that I wrote under the leadership of my advisor, Beth Herbel-Eisenman. It's a Jeremy article entitled Mapping Mathematics in Classroom Discourse. And it shares about an analytic framework for tracing the mathematical meanings across multiple phrasings in discourse. The key idea in that one is that it's important to describe mathematical relationships and mathematical meanings in many different words and different registers, not just reiterate the same definition over and over again. The meaning actually comes from gleaning the structure or semantic relationships that underlie the various words that people use. And so as a researcher, it's helpful to be able to analyze for that. The third most citations is for an article I wrote with Xander DiRaggio and Salih Barishi about flipped instruction. It's from the journal Teaching and Teacher Education, and the article is Mathematics Teachers' Motivations for, Conceptions of, and Experiences with Flipped Instruction. This article is from the multi-year project that Xander and I led, looking at flipped instruction in algebra. Not because we think flipped instruction is the best thing ever, but just because it was a phenomenon that we wanted to better understand. In that particular Tate article, the main idea we presented was a reinterpretation of the classic instructional triangle of teacher, student, and content. With flipped instruction, the teacher is only vicariously present during the content delivery phase. But during the practice phase, the triangle is intact in flipped instruction, and the teachers in the flipped case actually reported stronger connections between students and content during flipped instruction than during the practice phase of regular non-flipped instruction. And finally, the fourth most citations for me is on another topic that I've studied for many years, reasoning and proving opportunities for secondary students. The article that's gotten the most attention is the one that Lorraine Mayles, Nick Gilbertson, Dan Clark, and I wrote for the journal Mathematical Thinking and Learning, The Mathematical Nature of Reasoning and Proving Opportunities in Geometry Textbooks. This article contains one big idea, which is that when we're looking at the reasoning and proving opportunities in textbooks, we shouldn't just look at what kind of activity is expected of students, like conjecturing, proving, or finding a counterexample. And we shouldn't just look at the grade level or the topic as context for the reasoning and proving opportunities. We should also pay attention to the generality of the mathematical statements that students are having to reason and prove around. We argue that only general statements about entire classes of mathematical objects really motivate deductive reasoning. And so it becomes a bit worrisome that the student exercises in textbooks are mostly all particular statements instead of general statements. And it's the textbook narrative, not the exercises, that usually contains the general claims. Okay, with all that being said as preamble, the thing that I've been reflecting on are these next four articles that are sort of underrated or underappreciated. So I'm just going to claim host privileges and share some more of my work briefly. Going from the most recent one, we have a research report in the International Journal of Research and Method in Education. And this was written by Paul Wansavage, myself, Amber Candela, and Xander DiRaggio. It's entitled, The Modality of Mathematics Lesson Observations, Comparing the Results of Live and Video-Based Coding. And that's what our analysis did. We just straight up compared what was seen and coded during lesson observations when some of our team went and watched the lesson live in person, and other members of our team only watched the lesson through the Swivel video recording. And we mixed and matched those conditions, but there was always a live coding that was happening with a couple people, and then there was a video coding that was happening with a couple people. We did this analysis because we were about to embark on a large-scale data collection project that included 50 math classrooms across multiple states. And so before we did that, we wanted to check in advance about what might be gained or lost if we did that large-scale data collection through lesson observations that were video recorded and uploaded to the cloud. How does that video lesson coding compare to our past process, which was always to have two people visit the classroom in person? Of course, there are way too many things to look at in any one lesson observation, but in the article, we report on all the dimensions that were from our specific observation protocol. And in summary, we found fairly high levels of agreement between video coding and live coding, which made us more confident to subsequently rely on that video coding in our next data collection. But there were some noteworthy differences that we laid out in the article. For example, We coded for the mathematical development of the lesson. That is, how much conceptual development or justification of the math content is included as part of the lesson discourse. And on this dimension, the live coders tended to mark things consistently higher than the video coders. Not like 100%, but there was a kind of definitely a leaning towards the live coders marking that math concept development higher. We tried to speculate about what might have caused this difference, and we think maybe there's a subconscious thing like, oh, I get what you're saying, that maybe is happening to the coders who are in the room, but that the video coders are immune from. Now, we aren't sure if that is what explains the difference, but we did see a difference across many different classrooms and different grade levels on that dimension of the concept math development. Another difference was in coding the number of students who are publicly involved in the whole class discourse. The live coders tended to mark more students as publicly contributing to the discourse than did the video coders. In this case, we speculate that it may just be limitations of the video camera's field of view and limitations of like the ability for the video coder to be able to see the individual speakers. There were some other differences as well, and so if researchers are going to be looking at some of those dimensions of the lessons, they may need to be cautious about their observation methodology. But again, on most of our dimensions, like lesson connections, math representations, math authority, student contribution length, student engagement, teacher circulation, on those ones, there wasn't really a systematic bias in either direction. And so at least based on our analysis, people can feel comfortable using either observation modality, whatever makes more sense for your research design or your capabilities. I like this article a lot. The graphs are nice and clear, and I want more people to know about it because I think lots of people are either using or considering video observations rather than live visits to classrooms. And this article can help you think through any possible biases or challenges that might arise in your particular case. All right, the next underrated article is one that was probably the scariest one to write and to actually submit to possibly get published. In the article, we directly challenge a widely accepted idea in math education. But we didn't mean it in any sort of like personal way. In fact, we like and we respect all the scholars that were involved. But we also felt like as part of the scientific endeavor and as a trying to be a responsible purveyor of math education research, we felt like we had to check some of our foundations. So the idea in question is the widely held belief in math education that high cognitive demand tasks are positively associated with student learning. Maybe it's hard to tell that that's positively associated with students' procedural learning, but certainly we feel like, you know, as a field, high cognitive demand is positively associated with conceptual learning. Everyone seems to be accepting this relationship as true. But for myself, back during my dissertation study at Michigan State, I had data from like 12 middle school classes, and I could not find anything even close to an association between the task demand and the student learning measures. But I was a doc student, and that was not a huge study. It was just my dissertation, so I kind of filed it away. But then I got a little more curious about this phenomenon when I noticed that most people only cited one article, Stein and Lane, 1996. That's what they cited when they made claims about the link between cognitive demand and student learning. Now, of course, there's a bunch of studies that are about cognitive demand or about mathematical task enactment. But with regard to the link to student learning, it seemed like it was almost always Stein and Lane 1996 that was holding up that claim. And in Stein and Lane 1996, the sample size there was just 4. And the design only allowed for correlational links, nothing causal. So I was getting curious. And I got even curiouser when I talked to Mary Kay Stein herself. We were at a conference together near the posters. I was talking to her about this, and she actually said back then in the 90s, it was very hard for them to find that association between cognitive demand and student learning. They had to look at only certain items in order to find that relationship. So that made me curiouser. And now more recently, by the way, there's been additional studies with like more robust design. So Ni, Zhao, Jin Fukai, and others, they published a large-scale study in the Journal of Educational Research. And they, too, like my dissertation, they could not find an association between cognitive demand and student learning measures. They had 3 student learning measures, I think. They couldn't find that link, but they did find a positive correlation between cognitive demand and students' interest in math, but not a link to their learning on those 3 learning measures. But how does this relate to the article? Well, what happened for the article is that my colleagues, Corey Webel and Zandra DiRaggio, we were talking around the office and out for lunch, and we were talking, and we also became, as a group, interested in looking more closely at this situation. Because it seemed fairly central to a lot of our work in math ed, and a teacher preparation, this link between cognitive demand and student learning. So we used Google Scholar, we pulled all the articles that cited Stein and Lane 1996, and what we analyzed was we analyzed the claims that those authors were making when they cited Stein and Lane. We also looked at whether they cited any other studies in support of the same claim. Maybe there is other research besides Stein and Lane that's like backing up this claim. And whatever they cited, there were just a few. We inspected those as well to try to check the extent to which this evidence base is actually supporting the claim that cognitive demand of tasks is linked to student learning. So we did that analysis. It's published in the Journal of Mathematical Behavior. And the article's called Inspecting the Foundations of Claims About Cognitive Demand and Student Learning, a Citation Analysis of Stein and Lane 1996. What we found, I think, may surprise quite a few people in the field, but I'm not sure how many people have actually read the article. I know some have, but I'm not sure how many. Selfishly, my suggestion is that any graduate program that has Stein and Lane 1996 or has a deep dive into the cognitive demand literature, I think should also have our article in JMB as a supplementary piece. Okay, moving on to number three. I still think a lot about this analysis that I did stemming back to my grad school work with Beth Herbelizeman and Michelle Cirillo. On that team, we spent a lot of time looking at classroom discourse, mostly in middle school math classes. And one particular activity that we ended up focusing on a lot was homework review, or going over homework. This was a very common activity within the classrooms that we were studying. And I really enjoyed the analysis we did, where we looked at the discourse patterns across all the instances of going over homework in the data set. We published this in both Teachers College Record and also Mathematics Teaching in the Middle School. The main idea from this work is that the structure of going over homework discourse tends to guide people's attention to one problem at a time. Just think about students asking to go over number 10 or number 27. Or think about that discourse pattern of a teacher who picks a certain problem to talk through that as the homework review. This was very common, but we showed how it keeps the attention on just progressing through one problem and not focusing on the patterns or the connections across problems. And yet, going over homework seems like a good time when students could actually step back to look at what's happened across the problems. Now that they've actually like tried them, they can step back and look across. In the MTMS article, we did actually share some suggestions for teachers about how to possibly reorient homework review so that you can look across problems. So I really like that bit of work we did in those articles, and I still think about it all the time whenever I see classroom discourse that slips into a one-at-a-time sort of frame. All right, and to finish out this retrospective look at a few of my sort of underrated articles, I want to go back to 2011 to an article in Mathematics Teacher called Cornered by the Real World: A Defense of Mathematics. Now, I call this article underrated, but really it's only underrated in terms of citations. It's only got 10 citations, so that's less than one per year, ouch. But this article is actually the one for which I've gotten the most positive response from teachers, as measured by emails from all over the country and all over the world, and people mentioning it at conferences when I see teachers. And it also got a nice shout out from Dan Meyer at some conferences. But I still want to boost this article a bit because I just like the article. It's an essay that takes on the question, why do I need to learn this? And the article breaks down a bunch of different answers that people try to give to that question. I point out why each of the answers doesn't really satisfy the students, and in some cases, it can definitely backfire. For example, if a student is not enjoying a math topic and they say, why do I need to learn this? And then the teacher says, well, you'll need it if you want to become an engineer. I contend that this could backfire. It's more likely that the answer will drive that student away from engineering rather than that the answer will take some latent desire for engineering and use it to propel them to re-engage in the math topic. So in the article, I go through a whole set of different answers, but the bigger idea of the article is that there's a bigger mistake happening. I think many of us often conflate the question, why do I need to learn this, with the question, when will I ever use this? A lot of times people just put those two questions together. I think those are actually two different questions. To learn something and to use something are not the same thing. And to use something in sort of like everyday life is not the only reason that we might want to learn something. If a student is expressing a frustration with the math or with the particular lesson, and they say, why do I need to learn this? And then if we as teachers try to answer it with, well, here's a situation where you might use it, I think that we have fallen into that conflation trap. We should not try to justify all math learning by listing a particular use of that math. That greatly limits what we might be able to do in math class, at least at the high school level and above. Similarly, I don't think we should try to motivate every math lesson by having a real-world application. In some cases, that works great. But as a general principle, I think we should motivate math lessons by uncovering new patterns or generalities, developing new superpowers as a mathematical problem solver, or, yes, in some cases, making a real-world connection. And by the way, I wrote a spiritual sequel to that math teacher article when I wrote in the Mathematics Enthusiast in 2022 a review of Andrew Hacker's book, The Math Myth. In that book review, I acknowledged this frustration from students about learning so many seemingly irrelevant topics in secondary math. And I actually agree with Andrew Hacker that not so many topics have to be crammed and covered in the school curriculum. But I don't think the solution is to replace abstract topics with consumer math or real-world math topics. I think the solution is to reduce the number of topics and increase the focus on big ideas and on mathematical processes and on productive collaboration and sense-making together. So that's my rundown. I thank you so much for going with me on this self-indulgent episode, but I really do enjoy this sort of thing at the end of the year and the 200 episode mark where I've posted lots of episodes about other people's research. This seemed like a good spot for me to look back at a few of the big ideas that have been woven throughout my own writing. I will have a more standard episode with a guest that will post before the end of the year, so that will wrap up the 2024 season. Keep an eye out for that wherever you get your podcasts. And remember that now the whole podcast is on YouTube Music as a podcast playlist. But then please come back in January for a brand new 2025 season of the podcast. I am incredibly excited about the first guest I have lined up for 2025, which will be a significant new entry to the series of senior scholar career retrospectives. I won't say who it is just yet, but I will say that I can't do it partway. It has to be all in for the new year episode. Thanks again for listening. Have a great semester break and take care in the new year.